Welcome to the Wrestling Philosophy Show, where we discuss unique perspectives and beliefs on the sport of wrestling. Give us a follow or subscribe on various social media platforms, including YouTube, Spotify, and Apple Podcasts. Enjoy the show.
All right, welcome, Dan Sweeney, DPS Breakdowns. Great to finally meet you.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, we're very close in proximity. Next time we'll have to do this in person, but
for sure.
For listeners, Dan, Twitter description, right? And I think it sums it up perfectly. Student of grappling arts and creator of breakdown videos. And for those that don't know, right, big in on YouTube, right? All your breakdowns of grappling, wrestling, jiu-jitsu, right? That's kind of your niche, right?
Yeah. So, you know, it's funny, I've gotten really into the wrestling breakdowns, but I'm actually really more of a jiu-jitsu guy. That's what I consider myself. And when I first started making breakdown videos, they were all jiu-jitsu based. And then I made a David Taylor ankle pick video, you know, breaking down his ankle pick that he's known for. And it kind of like took off on YouTube and did really well, like way better than my other videos. And it kind of made me, and I really enjoyed making it and kind of like researching it. And it made me think, well, wow, I can maybe do more of those. It was just going to be a one-off kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And then I kind of just like started doing wrestling breakdowns and really never looked back. It's kind of strange to think about now. But yeah, really at this point, it's just wrestling breakdowns. I still train and teach jiu-jitsu. You know, I'd like to get into wrestling coaching at some point, but it's not something that I've really done to date. That's why I put the grappling in there. So it covers jiu-jitsu and wrestling. And then, you know, I like doing a little sumo here and there, throw a couple of sumo videos in, judo every now and again.
Yeah.
So, you know, all the grappling arts have a lot of similarities. There's differences, of course, but, yeah, they're all cool in their own ways. So I try to, right now it's very much wrestling, but it's just grappling kind of in general is the focus.
And what's crazy is, so if you follow wrestling, you've probably seen one of your videos, right? People don't realize it, whether it's being shared or through YouTube, whatever. I mean, you have a really good following, what, 28,000 people on YouTube or something wild, right? It's a lot, right? But I didn't realize you're from Ohio. I've watched your videos and I'm like, wow. Didn't someone brought you? Yeah, he's from Ignatius. I'm like, what? No way. Like, you know, I didn't even know. So go back, right? You wrestled 2 years at Ignatius, right?
Yeah.
I guess. Did you grow up doing jiu-jitsu or what kind of?
No.
Wrestling first, jiu-jitsu first? What was it?
I didn't do anything. I mean, I didn't do any grappling sports. I did like Hapkido, I think it was, when I was very young. But, you know, that's like a striking martial art of sorts. And then, you know, I played football. I played basketball. Kind of just like, you know, mainstream popular sports. Baseball. And then at Ignatius, the wrestling coach came in there, who, you know, Mark Sullivan,
right?
He came in the room after football season was over and kind of like gave a little speech trying to get guys to try it out. Mm-hmm. And I gave it a shot and I really liked it. And unfortunately I had a couple, you know, season ending injuries over the years that limited me to just 2 years. But I think I really loved like the development of it, like how you could, you go in the first day and I just remember just getting ragdolled and just having no idea that was going to happen. You think you're going to like, you know, hold your own and you just get destroyed. And, and I thought that was really, I actually thought that was really cool. It was disheartening, but then cool at the same time. Cause then you realize like these people are beating you in large part because of technique. They just know what they're doing and you don't. And so I really kind of fell in love with that development aspect of like building your skill over time and being like responsible for like building your own game kind of thing.
Kind of the building blocks and kind of just adding to that technique, right?
Yeah. And I remember when I was younger, I used to get like nervous for other sports, but for some reason in wrestling, I don't know why to this day. And I had the same experience with jiu-jitsu. I always just felt like comfortable doing it. So that kind of like resonated too. Like I just loved competing. And I loved just like getting better. And you'd be even with a guy in the room, and then over the course of the season, maybe you pass him up, which is always kind of like a satisfying feeling. So there's like that very competitive nature to it. And so I took that kind of passion into jiu-jitsu, you know, when I was 18, and, you know, I've been training jiu-jitsu since 2008, and, you know, competed in, you know, dozens of tournaments over the, you know, over the course of that time. And so kind of a roundabout way of saying, I started briefly in wrestling, then went to jiu-jitsu. And then through these breakdown videos, I kind of rekindled my passion for wrestling. And I guess here I am. So
when did that start? The breakdown, was it more for a learning purpose for yourself, or what was the spark to do the breakdown videos?
Yeah. So I was always kind of interested in the ankle pick takedown. And the reason I was interested actually was a guy named Dave Habit, who, you know,
You wrestled with Dave and Jerome Robinson. So you were Ignatius at one of their peak times, right?
Uh-huh. Yeah. So I remember I went to the Jeff Jordan state champ camp. I still remember this like pretty vividly for some reason. And after one of the sessions, I was just like picking Dave's brain about his ankle pick, because he was really good at it, especially, I mean, he's great at it now, but in high school, he was just destroying people with it. And I remember he like showed me like how he does it, how he sets it up. And ever since then, it was kind of like a move that I took it to jiu-jitsu and had a lot of success with it there. And so, you know, I guess studying David, it was just like kind of fun to study it, because David Taylor's like known for it. Right. And so I made the breakdown video of him doing it. And then that kind of led me back on the path to getting into wrestling again.
Right. And then see David's, you know, success recently at the Olympics, right? Oh, how cool is that? So
it's amazing.
Yeah. Did you, you know, what's your thoughts, you know, on that? Did you break down a lot of film from the Olympics
what's
your thoughts on Olympics? Yeah.
Talk on that. So start with David Taylor, I guess. I'm so fascinated by his game, because it really, to me, like when I watch him, it all revolves around like his ankle pick mechanics. Mm-hmm. So he doesn't, the way I think about the ankle pick is like, it can be just like a standalone takedown, or it can be like an entry to like other takedowns. Mm-hmm. And he uses it more for the latter. Like he's using it to get onto his, to get into his single legs, get into his double legs. It's all like the same footwork essentially, or very similar. But man, he has success against everybody with it. It's amazing. I mean, he ran through all his opponents at the Olympics up until the finals, which was a close match. And that was a really interesting match, because Yazdani, his opponent, he clearly came in with like a strategy to slow it down. And because if you had watched their two prior matches, Yazdani had a lot of success early, but then he just totally gassed out.
Right.
And so in this third match, I think he was like, all right, I'm going to keep it the pace a lot slower, less scrambles. And then, you know, I won't gas and hopefully win a tight one, which was a pretty good plan up until the last, I don't know, 20 seconds, right? Like he was up. But I mean, you got to hand it to DT, man. He came up with a really, really clutch takedown at the end. He's amazing. I mean, when's the last time he's lost? It's been years, right?
Especially that injury, you know, setback, you know, you didn't know how he was going to come back from that. Right. And it's kind of, so.
Yeah. I mean, the U.S., both the men and women's freestyle teams looked really good for the most part. I mean, who else? Gilman, he wrestled almost flawlessly.
Yeah. Right, that first match, it was right there too, right?
He drew the toughest guy in the bracket, was winning up until the last, I don't know, 20 seconds, 15 seconds, whatever it was. Was getting in cleanly on all of his shots. And then, you know, he came back from that loss and basically crushed the next two guys, from what I can remember. took bronze. He looks really good. He's another guy that a lot of his takedowns, or at least a few that I saw at the Olympics, were coming off those ankle pick mechanics. He does like this stagger step, and then he's off a collar tie, reaches with the other arm. And then from there, he can, once he has the ankle, he can transition to another takedown. So I don't know if that's like the Kale model at Penn State. Yeah. I know Gilman's training there now.
Yeah, but most of the guys are right.
Yeah, Snyder was good doing ankle picks before he went to the Nittany Lions Club, but they look as good as ever. Snyder was another guy. Amazing performance. I think a lot of people thought it was a done deal that Sagalaya was going to win the gold. And it turned out to be a really close finals match. I mean, it really came down. Sagalayev didn't
take score. Him down, did he? It was just
no dips, yeah, right? No off. Right. It was, he defended a couple of shots and he got exposure in those sequences, which was, you know, obviously impressive, but he seemed to have a lot of respect for Snyder, right? Like he was not being aggressive or trying to like force anything. Mm-hmm. So I think if they wrestle again, Snyder could for sure win the next one. I mean, he's beaten him before. Mm-hmm. So that was a cool match to see. And then, I mean, I can go on all day about this, but
so when you're watching, you know, high level wrestling like that, I mean, do you watch a lot of international events, or I guess what I'm getting at is when you watch these, do you enjoy it, or is your mind always thinking like, how am I going to break this down? Or I guess what's your process of what's your mind, you know, what's going through your mind when you're watching high level wrestling?
That's a good question. Sometimes I like, cause I like just watching it mm-hmm. as just like a fan at like full speed. So sometimes I just force myself to just watch it and try to enjoy it. And then, you know, later I'll break it down. But yeah, I definitely get a little bit antsy when because when I watch it at full speed, like I miss pretty much everything that's happening as far as like the nuances. I have to slow it down at, you know, once it's recorded. But yeah, I do kind of struggle with that in the sense that like, I feel like I'm almost in kind of like breakdown mode. Whereas like sometimes I just want to like have fun and watch it. But yeah, for the Olympics, I felt like I was kind of in work mode in the sense that I was, you know, recording while I was watching and then trying to put out content like every day. Just little clips, like 10-second clips, and then trying to give a little, most of it for that has been on Twitter and Instagram, just because it's easier to do like smaller clips. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of been the latest kind of iteration of my breakdowns, is just short clips, give a description in however many characters Twitter gives you, try to do it in like one post. And then, you know, people seem to be liking that from what I can tell. And it's a lot easier to kind of pump out the content that way.
Right. So for the listeners that haven't seen your videos, I mean, you get the graphics in there and it's pretty detailed. It's exciting as a coach watching how you break it down. It's like, you know, you gotta have a special analysis, you know, mindset that way. It's pretty cool seeing how you break things down. Obviously, like I said earlier, you have the following. Are there other techniques that you like breaking down? You know, you mentioned the ankle pick, but other techniques that you like breaking down, that, you know, different variations?
Yeah. So I've been getting really into, I don't even know the name of it. So I've been calling it a skip step. It's basically like the footwork that people use when they shoot in on a leg or double leg, I guess. And I've noticed like a ton of high level guys. Alec Pantaleo is like the name that comes to mind, cause I've seen him just do this like every match recently. He's been pretty active. He's doing this thing where he drops to a lead knee and then he like aggressively swings his back leg forward, like his drive leg is swinging forward, and he's able to get like an incredible amount of depth on his shots that way. And I guess it's interesting to me because I'm kind of like a technique nerd. Like I watch, instructionals and YouTube videos of people, like coaches breaking down stuff or showing a move. And I don't ever really see it taught, and maybe I've just missed it, but it's like one of those things that's like becoming like more and more of a trend. And I feel like it still hasn't been really taught to date, at least not that I've seen.
Do you have a video you break it down that if, listeners watch right now, do you have a video they should search on your YouTube
page? Yeah. So
your specific one?
I actually don't think I've broken it down in like a formal YouTube video.
Okay.
I'm trying to think. I know that I've put a lot of content out on it on Twitter and Instagram as well. I see a ton of guys are doing that now, and it's not like anything brand new. Like if you go back, like there were guys doing it probably forever to some extent, but I just see like
more often.
I see tons of guys doing it. And it makes sense in the sense that, the number one way or one of the biggest ways a shot fails is like, you don't get deep enough and the guy sprawls on you. And there's like a big gap between your hips and their hips. And I feel like this is like a really good method to kind of close the space down. That's one. And then, I've always been interested in underhooks for some reason. I don't really know why, but I'm interested in, I like watching international wrestling because you get to see other styles that maybe aren't as common in the US.
Right. So
for an example with the underhook, I watch a lot of the Iranian wrestlers. They're kind of known for the underhook game there. And one thing that they do a lot that I've talked about on Twitter probably a lot, but is they're really big on opposite side head position when they get an underhook, which is like very different than what you'll typically see taught in the US.
Right.
So, and I'm sure, you've been around the wrestling game forever. You've coached, competed. Most people will say, well, you get an underhook, you got to get head position, head on the same side. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that, but I'm also thinking, well, there's a lot of good stuff when you put that on the opposite side too. So like there's a lot of high level guys that have success with the head on the opposite side. So it's just interesting to me. It's just different styles, and you can make different positions work differently.
Right. The opposite what we normally know, and they're making it work for them. Right.
Yeah. I try not to just watch it and like talk about it. I also try to like get in the gym and train it a little bit and, see what that position, like I want to contrast the same side versus the opposite side. Like what do I feel the differences are? What, like I try to get feedback from my partner. Like, what do you feel? Do you feel like it's harder for you to get out when my head's here versus there? Or if I try to attack this leg when my head's there, are you able to counter it better? So like try to tinker with it a little bit myself. That's another one, the underhook in general. And then also just like the head position kind of topic is something I find interesting.
So are you competing still in jiu-jitsu and coaching, or just competing or just coaching?
So I am, I actually teach like a wrestling for jiu-jitsu class now. It's Hurricane Jiu-Jitsu. It's in the West Park area, if you're familiar, in Cleveland.
Okay.
So like just west of downtown, I guess. So I teach that, and then I just, I teach like a regular no-gi.
Zeb and I had Dave Happ, speaking Dave Happ, we had up Dave on him. The joke was west side of West Park, right? Probably about a month ago, right after the last chance there, we had Dave on it. Awesome interview. And then he was up at Burnett's. But it was west side of West Park. So that's where your working club is. Okay.
I forgot Dave was from there. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's where we're at. So I teach that class, and then I teach a no gi jiu-jitsu class, basically without the gi on. I actually haven't competed in a couple of years. I've had some neck issues, herniated disc in my neck. That's kind of made it tougher to train consistently as much as I would like when I'm competing. So it's been a few years, but certainly plan on getting back into it at some point.
Okay. So when you break down, you know, I don't know anything about jiu-jitsu, as I said. When you break down your videos, or where are you finding the footage for jiu-jitsu, or where would you recommend someone learning about jiu-jitsu? You know, is it Flow? Do they have some, is it Flow Grappling, or what? What are the channels, I guess, that people can look and find some content?
Yeah, so it depends what you want. If you want competition footage, so Flow definitely has a lot of stuff. I think if you're a member of Flow Wrestling, I think the way it works, you also get access to Flow Grappling. And they put on a ton of live events. And I actually am so in the wrestling world now, I mostly just watch wrestling events and not jiu-jitsu events.
Right.
But from what I've heard, the jiu-jitsu events on Flow Grappling are really well done. So, you know, if you're already a member through Flow Wrestling and you want to check out a jiu-jitsu event, I think there's an event called Who's Number One. That's pretty popular. It's
coming up. Or the wrestling one, right? It's coming up.
Okay.
The jiu-jitsu is, but yeah, the rest.
Yeah. So those are worth checking out. What else? I mean, so the IBJJF is kind of like the big federation for jiu-jitsu. So if they have a YouTube channel with tons of competition matches uploaded, there is a absolute massive amount of just free content on YouTube related to jiu-jitsu. Jiu-jitsu does a pretty good job of marketing itself. It's all private businesses. So it's like all the instructors, a lot of them have their own YouTube channels and are putting out their own instructionals out there. So there's a ton of content, I would say, on YouTube. And then if you want to watch live events, you could do IBJJF or Flow Grappling. I would say those are kind of the big outlets for that.
Okay, cool. No, good to know. We talked off air a little bit, and you mentioned you're still, you know, you're coaching and everything. What's your take on the best way to structure a practice?
Ooh, so I was going to ask you that.
Oh, okay. Okay. Okay.
No, I mean, I want to pick your brain about that, because you're the coach here. Let me tell you how a jiu-jitsu practice is structured, and maybe you can contrast that with your experience with wrestling. So the way that we generally do it is that there's a warm-up of sorts, and that can totally vary. Some coaches will do like calisthenics or, you know, running. And I when I teach a class, I try to make it jiu-jitsu based. So like jiu-jitsu movements or a drill, or even just like hand fighting with your partner for 5 minutes, something like that. But in any event, there's a warm-up, and then there's like a move of the day, and so that or several moves of the day. And so those will be shown, you know, maybe for the next half hour. And, you know, you show a move and they go drill it for 7 minutes. Coach walks around, and then, you know, you bring everybody back, you show another move probably related to that, like the next step, or if they do this, you do that. And then after that, we typically would do specific sparring. So that means you're sparring in a particular position, usually the position that you had the technique in.
Okay.
And you do several rounds of that with like full resistance. So now you get like feedback kind of on the position you just drilled before. Now you're getting like more resistance. Mm-hmm. And then after that, it would just be, you know, live rounds. So it's 5, 7, 10 minute rounds. And the way we do it at the school I teach at, we start from the feet. So it's initially someone either gets a takedown or someone, it's called pulling guard. They just kind of sit, or, you know, they fall to the ground to get it on the ground. And you do however many of those you have left in the class as far as time. And then that's kind of it. That's, I would say that's the basic structure.
How long jiu-jitsu. Is a jiu-jitsu practice technically, then, or you traditionally?
Yeah, it varies, but I would say an hour to an hour and a half is kind of the average. So yeah, that would be the kind of the standard version, I would say.
Okay. So I guess if you were asking me that question, it really depends. You know, I coach at a very, very small high school, in Sandusky, so very small. So it it really depends on the level of our team and where we need to work. When we have bigger teams, it's a little bit different because you can kind of break up the room a little bit. But we've had some small teams, real small school, under 100 boys in the whole school. So, just try to keep it, so it's not monotonous and the same thing every day, but it's where we need the work. Okay. Is it, do we need more work on short offense? The last couple of years we've been working that a lot. And then obviously, making sure we, structure and practice, hour and a half or so, and then getting our weight training in. We're blessed to have our weight room right across the so if we're not hitting it in the morning, hitting it after practice or changing up, we hit it before practice, kind of try to change things up. But same thing, structure, a functional warm-up, jogging and throw some agility in there, type things, warm up. And then same concept, drilling, neutral positions, your traditional, what we're hitting, and then you throw something new in there and see where the room's at, right? And see what they're not hitting correctly. And all right, that's fine tune this. All right, we're working on this. You kind of read the room, but so it's not, I guess, with the smaller team, it's a little different, because it's a little more one-on-one, but and it's easier to see, okay, what the tendencies are. So, it's a lot different than when I wrestled. We had the same practice when I was in high school, and it worked though. When I was in high school, we had 40 guys in the room, but it was the same practice every day. And it was wild, but it worked. I mean,
what was that structure?
It was like, I'm getting old now, but we had to run 10 laps in the hallway in the wrestling shoot, up and around the school, 10 laps, and like half the kids would go hide the bathroom. The serious guys would, run the laps. Yeah. I think I'm gonna jump rope for a little bit, and it was, 20 minute drill. And it was like 20, we had so many guys in a room, was so small, we had to do groups of three for live, because we didn't have enough room, everyone couldn't wrestle at once. So in and out live every day, neutral, 1 minute goes, 21 minute goes, and then come back and do a little technique on the mat, and then, up, down, out, same thing, group of three. Our room was so small, and we'd have like 40 guys in the room. Like it's crazy to look back on how we made it work, but that's how it was, I guess.
Wow.
Kind of funny looking back, because it was like our new room, but it was so small back then, my seventh year. But but it worked, a lot of running into the wall, running into the pillars type stuff. So
That's cool.
You guys had a good size room. Oh, go ahead.
No, I was just gonna say that the 1 minute goes is interesting. What would you say is the general, if you're doing sparring when you're coaching from the feet, from neutral, is it like 1 or 2 minutes, or do you sometimes do longer? Like, what's the general like time for that?
See, that's a funny, and I don't mean to be vague, but actually, so this year with the small team, we had, for live goes neutral, we had to change it up a couple times this year. Like I said, it's trying to always evolve, right? But we kind of knew in the room, the pecking order of the room. So, that we had guys that, were, dominant in the room, right, in their respective weight classes. So it's like, how do we push those guys if they know if they can go out there and take a guy down every time, right? So we said, all right, you get the takedown, you stay in, right? So he had the guys right in his face after he gets the takedown, because he didn't want to give it up. So he might have been in there for 20 minutes straight if we're going 20 minutes, and he wasn't giving up the takedown. So we'd throw that in there once in a while, or it'd be Russell till someone gets to take, it's match simulation day, you wrestle a match, then we kind of, take it easy, and then you come back with another match and try to rotate partners. But we had to get real creative, long story short, because we had such a small room. Wasn't like a traditional, you have your, your Ignatius. How many kids on team did you have when you're Ignatius?
Jeez, I have to think about that. It was a lot.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, I mean,
you guys have a good sized room too, right?
Pretty good sized room. Yeah, I think I don't think we had to do multiple heats, maybe two heats, but no more than that. Yeah, there was a lot. I mean, I felt like every year there was tons of freshmen that would do it. Even guys like me who didn't have any experience coming into it. I think Sullivan does a good job kind of recruiting people, both experienced people and people brand new.
Was Tim Morrison there when you were there?
He was, yeah.
Yeah, yep. I still keep in touch with him. He runs the grade school district. He'll shoot a text from time to time.
Nice. Yeah, yeah. Yep. He was there. Yeah.
He's coached for a while too. He coached back in the day. Oh man, all over the place. Yeah. Good guy. He's been around this sport for a while. But yeah, good questions on this. Like I said, over the years it's changed. Like we got a bigger room now, so we don't have our spacious issue. But it just really depends on the room, you know, and type of guys we had. I mean, we graduated a lot this past year, so it's going to be a lot different even next year. And kind of I tried to put that in the younger underclassmen this past year, like, look, these guys are gonna be gone, let's start, you know, that's how we're going to be working next year when these guys are gone. You know, we got to think of that through. So so yeah, good question. I don't know, it's I guess a moving target, right? Like anything.
Yeah. Yep. So. And I guess it also probably depends, you know, if it's earlier in the season, later in the season, like that can dictate things as well. Or off season, you know. Right. So,
yep. Nope, you're exactly right, and you know, kind of, you know, if you're coming off a Friday Saturday tournament, and then you've got a duel on Wednesday, or you know, it really depends. You know, are we in January? Are we over? You know, Christmas break. But we try to change it up. You know, in the past, we actually did a lot of, you know, one night a week with the swim team to change it up for cardio. You know, all right, no conditioning tonight, but we're going. With the swim team and swim in some laps or something, you know, just change it up, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I think, right, the kids are, you got to keep them mentally, you know, guessing too, right? Keep their body guessing, right? So, so yeah, I don't know. Good question on the structure of practice, but it's a moving target, I guess. So, you know, going back and how you break down your videos, right? You kind of said you kind of sometimes it just depends on the medium, right? You know, whether it's Twitter or Instagram, right? I guess when did you kind of see it take off, right? You kind of get a following, right? Because probably at the beginning you're probably doing it for yourself, kind of, all right, here, I'm gonna break this down to learn and kind of put it out there. I guess was there a moment you kind of like, whoa, this is the thing, like people are watching what I'm doing? Or was it from the rip people watch what you did?
Yeah, definitely not from the rip. Yeah. So it's funny what you said, like me doing it is like, I think I would be doing the exact same thing if nobody was watching.
Right. It's kind of your pride.
Yeah. So
therapeutic, but it's probably like, okay, this is where my mind's at and how I break it down. Right. You enjoy doing it. Right.
Yeah. So it's, I learn a lot. I probably learn more than anybody watching it. Cause I, you know, I have to like, kind of figure out in my own head before I present it, you know, I'm presenting it how I see it too. So it's definitely an exercise in trying to figure out what's going on here. I don't know if there's any one moment. There's a couple, you know, the way that social media works, whether it's YouTube, Twitter, Instagram, you're very much beholden to the algorithm. And so I've had, and I'm sure you know that, I've had a few videos that for whatever reason just take off. And so I think,
and you didn't even think it would going in, right?
And like I feel like I've done better videos that nobody watched. You know what I mean? Like it's kind of just
funny,
it's
how
just
it like works, right?
Yeah. I did a video on this Russian wrist snap move. And it's like a 2-minute video. It took a few hours to make. And it's like, I think by far my most watched video.
All right.
And for whatever reason, it just, I don't know if it's like,
what's the title?
The Russian, I think it's Russian wrist snap, or Russian snap. If you okay. Google that, or put it on YouTube, it should pop up. It's.
And your YouTube channel, it's deep. If you type in DPS breakdown, right?
Yeah. It'll come right up. Yeah, DPS breakdowns. You'll see a video, and then you can click the channel from there.
I don't want to forget, but that's your Twitter and Insta right handles too, right?
Yeah. Yep. Yeah,
okay. Sorry, but go ahead.
No, you're good. So yeah, so that the Russian wrist snap. It's this cool move. This one guy, I don't know how to say his name. Like I read it a lot, but Gadev, G-E-U-D-E-F or something.
He's
the guy that Jordan Burroughs had a couple matches against. He beat Burroughs at the last Olympics in 2016. And then I know Burroughs beat him, I think, the year before at Worlds. But really talented guy. He did this. He popularized this move where he would, it's hard to explain, you kind of have to see it, but he would essentially have a wrist control. He would throw the wrist. First of all, he would do a fake with his other hand that didn't have the wrist. Like he was faking like a low shot, and that would get the opponent's, they would kind of like kick their feet back a little bit.
It'd be like a fake crossbody shot. Yeah. They'd have a wrist, fake crossbody.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Like just like a fake ankle pick or something, but it wasn't like a big commitment. It was just kind of like a little level change and fake, and gets a certain reaction. And then he pulls the wrist across their body. And if the timing's right, it just, their feet are kind of like momentarily off the ground or unbalanced because of the fake, and it sweeps them right off their feet. It's pretty amazing to see it. Really cool move, but in any event, he made it famous, and the video mostly has him, and it has a couple other guys too. But so that video did well. And then I've had a couple other ones that did really well. So those were kind of moments where I was like, you know, there's actually a big audience for this. People really, really like this stuff. And I guess not to go too off on a tangent, but there's a jiu-jitsu guy named BJJ Scout. And he was kind of the original competition film breakdown guy.
Okay.
And that's what gave me the idea to start doing this stuff. So he was doing it for jiu-jitsu, and I found that it was really valuable. I was taking the stuff he was doing, and I was able to like apply it on day one or day two after just drilling it a little bit. Mm-hmm. And I think the value in it is that you're seeing a move, how it's actually working against like a high level opponent in most cases. And so it almost has like instant credibility in the sense, you know, that there's something to it. You know, somebody shows you a random move against a person that's non-resisting, you never really know if that's right, going to work or if it'll work for you. But I think seeing it in the competition setting, you can really isolate what the person's doing.
Reality, right?
Yeah. You're slowing it down frame by frame. You're seeing the same person hit the same move four or five or six times against different opponents or more than that. And so I think in people's minds, it builds credibility. And then I think you're going to pick up details that person is doing that person might not even know they're doing, which I think that's really interesting. Like, I think a lot of high level guys are doing stuff that they may not even necessarily know they're doing. They're so skilled and they're so intuitive in their technique. It's like, they're not thinking about their technique when they're doing it.
Right.
But if you break it down frame by frame, you can see little nuances that I think they're just doing automatically. But for someone like me, who's not, you know, not a trained or a good wrestler in particular, if I can consciously like program that into my game, I can make like huge jumps.
Right.
Yeah. It might've taken this person like 5 years to find that exact way of doing it, but I can just kind of watch it and consciously implement it and maybe like make really good improvement that I would never have made without it. And so, yeah, the BJJ Scout guy made it big. So that kind of opened the door to this world of competition analysis, I think, at least from like a combat sports perspective.
Is film study big in jiu-jitsu? Is it pretty big? I mean, I know in wrestling we value it. We when I coach, we definitely watch film, you know, we break it down.
Yeah.
You guys did it, Ignatius. I'm sure you did, but
yeah,
you know, in the jiu-jitsu world, it's
really big. And I think the jiu-jitsu world, there's a lot more videos of like the stuff that I do in jiu-jitsu. I don't think there's a lot of there's a couple other guys that do what I do for wrestling as far as like, you know, publishing breakdown analysis videos. Mm-hmm. It's pretty popular. I'd say it's more popular in jiu-jitsu for whatever reason. And so, Yeah, I think it's a good tool. I obviously there's no substitute for learning in person and training, but if you can supplement your training with film study, I think that is, you're getting kind of the best of both worlds. So I think that's big.
No, it's definitely, I mean, you can get there a lot faster, like you said, right? I remember watching film in high school, imagine like, wow, I didn't realize I was doing this in a match. Mm. Look here, you know, cut this angle this way instead of this way. You know, like I said, I'm getting old. I don't remember it all, but I remember watching the video. I'm like, wow, I never realized I did that in a match, you know?
And it was, yeah.
You know, I'm grateful I had those coaches that spent the time, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's
go ahead.
And just one last point on that, just kind of the prevalence of competition footage out there. Like you can just,
right.
You can watch every match from 2019 Worlds on YouTube. That like every single match is up there, you know? So it's amazing. And it's all like, you know, HD quality and it's just a great time to, if you like studying film or you want to consider studying film, it's just so accessible now. So it's great.
Right. One thing we talked a little bit off air, and you know, the whole, you mentioned folk style disincentivizing upper body attacks. And did you have a thought on that or, we're talking about, right, people talking about freestyle and Greco and like, you know, do we need to be training freestyle more, less folk style, that whole conversation.
Yeah.
So I guess take it how you want. Do you want to talk about the upper body attacks or do you want to talk the freestyle?
So this is a controversial issue that I found. I guess I'm kind of in the wrestling world now, but I'm like kind of an outsider of sorts. So I can kind of see, things, I guess, from an outsider's perspective. And this is like a big issue that I've seen, especially on Twitter, for what that's worth. The wrestling Twitter, yeah. Is there's people that think that the U.S. is really hindering their progress at the international stage by having folk style. So yeah. They think that it would be more efficient to just wrestle freestyle because that's what you're going to do when you go to Worlds or what, you know, any other international competition. So that's one thing. There's people that say that there's aspects of folk style that are actually giving freestyle wrestlers advantages. They'll talk like, for example, this Keegan O'Toole, I'm not super familiar with him. I don't know if you heard about his performance at Junior Worlds. I think it was yesterday, but he was pinning everybody with cradles.
Cradle, right? A cradle.
And yeah.
It's wild, right? Picking them off the mat.
Yeah, deadlifting guys with cradles. Yeah. It was nuts.
That's exactly, I think I commented on him. I was like, that reason 101 why I had a deadlift right there, right? Yeah. Up with a cradle.
I know. That was wild. Yeah. But there are people that will say, well, that is his folk style influence because the cradle is very common in folk style. You do see it in freestyle, but certainly not to the same extent as you would in folk style. Another thing people will mention, the pace of folk style it gives an Americans an advantage because, you know, presumably the folk style pace with the mat game is a little bit higher than it is in freestyle. I don't know if that's totally true. It may be. But so I guess I'm kind of the lay of the land of what I see as far as the debate. And then my question was, and this is one for you, there's certainly an argument that the freestyle rule set is more better incentivizes upper body throws than folk style in the sense that if you hit a big throw in a freestyle match, the guy lands on his back, and then let's say he ends up on top of you right afterwards. You get 4 points for that.
Right.
Regardless of how
you didn't need to hold him there at all. You're getting four, right? Yeah. Yeah.
And in folk style, you get nothing. In fact, the other guy gets two and you get zero.
Right.
I like to think of examples. I always think of this Mark Hall throw. he had against Kemmerer, the Iowa guy. Mm-hmm. I think it was a couple of years ago. It was in, I think it was in the Iowa, is it Carver Arena? Mm-hmm. Is that what it's called?
Carver Hawkeye.
Mark Hall marches in there, gets double underhooks, jacks him up, and then hits this like amazing hip toss, like within like the first 20 seconds of the match, I think it was. And Kemmerer lands on his back, but it ends up, it's almost like such a good throw that there's so much momentum in it that he doesn't end up getting the takedown. In fact, I think Kemmerer ends up getting the takedown after like a little bit of a scramble. And so it was just like an example of, it would have been 4 points for Hall right off the bat there.
It creates more excitement, right?
Yeah. So, yeah. So I guess long way of asking you, what do you think about that idea of if you're like, if you want to make upper body wrestling more prevalent, or you like upper body wrestling, do you think that folk style rules are hindering that to some extent?
I just thought about something as you're saying that too. And I don't know how, you know, this is just off the rip. Maybe there's a point to that. Why we're so behind in Greco, right? If we're training folk style, right, and there's no advantage to trying those throws, right? So, you know, maybe if we were training freestyle earlier, right, it may translate into Greco, you know, type throws, because now it's, you know, incentivized, right? Because now we're throwing in a freestyle match, because I'll try it for four instead of giving up, you know, being down 2-0, I'm not going to try it, right? That's a great point. And I guess that's what kind of made me think right there, you know, and I don't have the answer. Like, why are we so far behind in Greco, right? Is it, you know yeah. I don't, you know, obviously you're not training it, right? We're training freestyle right after folk style. But I guess that's the first thing that comes to mind, right? If we're training freestyle at a younger age and there's incentive to throw because of that 4-point opportunity, that might translate. Okay, I'm having success with this. Let's transfer over into Greco. I don't know. You know, I don't know. That's just one thing that comes to mind. But, right. We all can agree a throw is, you know, obviously a double leg takedown by, you know, Jordan Burroughs is exciting, you know, when he's blasting through guys too, but a throw is, you know, that's what, that's whatever.
Nothing like it.
See, right. Right. And I was a headlock guy, you know, nothing fancy, but I liked a nice headlock guy pressured in. Yeah, I don't know. Maybe there's something there, right? You know, and I don't know freestyle that well, to be honest. I wrestled a little bit. I was old as 4. My brothers wrestled a lot more freestyle than me. I wish I wrestled more freestyle. So I understand it. And I'm just glad that the rule set is so close to folk style, right? Right. 10 years ago, right? They're right. So far apart, right?
And oh, really?
More. Yeah. The freestyle rules are so much closer to the folk style rules. So I think that's obviously an advantage for the U.S., which is awesome, right?
Yeah.
You know, we're away from the ball grab and all that stuff, but definitely. So I don't know. I guess I didn't really answer your question there, but I think there's something there with the Greco, right? If we learn freestyle throws and obviously, you know, the upper body attacks, there's something there that's gonna, I would have to think it's gonna influence our Greco teams down the road, right? And going back with the whole conversation on folk style freedom, I mean, like I said, I'm not in the Twitter wrestling universe.
Yeah. It gets heated on this topic.
Yeah, right. I mean, what were they saying about Gable then, right? Because Gable is a folk style guy. I mean, with him, you know, having success he did, what's their statement on that? Like, I don't know what they're saying if, you know, he's wrestling folks out for the most part, and then he just walks through. And I shouldn't say walk through, because that last match was close, but you know, he's training folk style. Not anymore, but you know what I mean?
Yeah, right. I think with him, if I was in like the freestyle camp, and I think people have said this, is I think he actually did have some pretty, I think he wrestled freestyle a decent amount when he was younger. I know he was like a junior world champ. So that's one.
You know, the freestyle, right? I mean, he's wrestling the freestyle season though, right? So, I mean, it's.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Obviously in the last, at least recently, was primarily a folk style guy in college. And then I think people would bring up his finals match. They would say, well, the U.S. is behind in the parterre game.
Right.
And he did. And, you know, he was up against, I think, the three or four time world champ. I forget exactly what his credentials were, but the guy from Georgia, and that guy did, I think, hit a couple gut wrenches on him. So people would say that's not necessarily against Gable, like personally, but they would just say in general, U.S. guys aren't as good on the mat because they're spending all this time doing folk style mat work and not working the freestyle or the Greco.
So the
debate is kind of funny because folk style to me has had amazing carryover to jiu-jitsu and I would say MMA. And so I think there's something to folk style in those regards, in the sense that in a combat situation, which I think MMA and jiu-jitsu are really trying to mimic. Jiu-jitsu doesn't have striking, but it's very much submission based.
Right. It's definitely in the MMA world, in the UFC and Bellator. It's there, right?
Yeah.
It's there.
So like in jiu-jitsu, if you hit an awesome throw, but the guy ends up on your back afterwards, that's like the worst thing that could happen, because, you know, someone has your back and that's the worst place to be. You're going to probably get choked. And so MMA is the same, similar thing. So in those sports, I would say the folk style is very much applicable. And then I don't know. I mean, I like folks. I think where I come out on it is that there's pros and cons to both. And that maybe that's a cop out, but I think it is weird in folk style. It's hard for me as a jiu-jitsu guy to like kind of wrap my head sometimes around if somebody hits, like, let's say they hit an arm throw and the guy, and they get like 4 points, but the guy's on their back right afterwards. It just seems kind of strange to reward that. Mm-hmm. Whereas in folk style, it's very much more in line with, like, you have to stabilize a good position before you get rewarded.
Right.
But then I go back and I'm starting to, I think, have a more acquired taste for freestyle, in the sense that their rule set incentivizes throws, which means there's going to be more of them. There's a slip rule thing where you miss a headlock and no worse for the wear. They just stand you back up and you're good to go. And so I think that leads to more throws because guys know that, and that makes it more fun to watch. And so, whereas in folk style, maybe guys are, they know they don't have a slip, so they're not going to go for as many throws, or they're not going to take the risk as much. So I guess I think both are good. I think if your only goal was to be, you know, an Olympic or world champ at the international level, I think there's a case to be made. I think there's a good case that you could just do freestyle your whole life. And right. that would be good.
What's the end game, right? Do you want to be, you know, do you want to be fighting in UFC, or do you want to be an Olympic medalist? Right. I mean,
yeah.
What's your path? Right.
Right. But obviously, I mean, as we've seen, you can win an Olympic gold medal with a very much a folk style kind of background. I mean, David Taylor, right. I'm sure he wrestled a lot of freestyle growing up, but he was primarily a folk style guy from what I know. Mm-hmm. At least up until the last 7 or 8 years when he's kind of committed full time. Right. But, you know, but then people would say, well, maybe he'd be even better if he just did, you know, it's hard to say because everyone's doing folk style in the U.S. for the most part.
It's, you know, 2020, right. It's pretty wild. Do you much breakdown of Greco, or is it mostly?
So I'll be honest with you, up until maybe, I don't know, 6 months ago, I did not watch any Greco. I didn't really know anything about it. I would see a couple clips here and there. And then I started getting really into it, like I said, I think about 6 months ago. I like it a lot. A lot of people think it's boring. That's like one of the big critiques.
Right.
What I do though, is I'm I'm very much, when I watch a match, I'm not watching it from beginning to end. I'm kind of like fast forwarding to the action moments.
Okay.
And so I, when an action moment happens in Greco, it's pretty sweet. You know, there's a lot of moments where maybe that doesn't happen, but the throws, there's nothing like a good Greco throw.
Right.
It's
I've never been a big Greco guy, but when you're watching a high level Greco match, it's completely different than a high level freestyle or folk style, right? Completely
different. It's its own. People talk about this too. I see conversations on this where it's so different than freestyle in a lot of ways. I mean, obviously people know like you can't like shoot for legs and that kind of thing, but it's just a very different skill set. And I think in the US we have, you know, most of our talent is going into the college level and then the freestyle level for the most part, you know, with some exceptions to that. But I think if you want to be really good at Greco as a country, I think you probably need to have people training Greco from the same age that they'd be training freestyle or folk style and develop them in that route. And then they're kind of, instead of going to, you know, a D1 school to wrestle in the NCAA, they would go to like a Greco school that does Greco, or they would just kind of skip the whole scholastic move, I guess.
Right. Harry Lester did. I mean, that was his route, right? And he's like, I'm going to go Greco and, you know, but yeah. It's a totally different world, right? Totally different, you know, approach.
Yeah, it's cool. The hand fighting is just so, man, it's so, and I'm by no means an expert in Greco, but from what I can tell, it's so nuanced, and there's, because the universe of things you can do is reduced in the sense that you can't, you know, attack the legs with your, you know, as for shooting in, it just makes the hand fighting just that much more, I guess, complex. There's just, the guys are just so like, they're just so good there. I think that's why maybe some of the matches people think are boring. Cause like, it's just
a margin of error you can have. Cause you're so, it's like, one less dimension, right? Because so there's this no air, you know, over here.
No, yeah, at the highest level, yeah, they're canceling each other out because they're not giving each other any avenues. Like they're not gonna like leave their elbows out to like get arm dragged, or they're not gonna like, you know, put themselves in any kind of bad position. It's really hard to get like double underhooks in a Greco. Like, you see it, but it's not easy to do. I think the most, if you want to watch really exciting Greco matches, watch like a high level guy against like lesser competition. Cause that's when you can like really see it. So like one video I have on YouTube is, I don't know if you're familiar with Xavier Johnson from the US.
No.
He represents the Marines.
Okay.
He represented the US at Pan Ams this past of what would it be, the, I guess, the summer or the spring, whenever that was. And he just annihilated everybody because, you know, the Pan Ams is a little bit lesser competition. It's right. South America, which isn't, you know, they're not known for their wrestling as much as say Europe or, you know, Asia.
You just walked.
And so it, oh my God, it's shocking what he did. He kept doing this high dive move where he ducks down. It's kind of like, it looks sort of like a double leg entry, but it's different. And you're essentially lowering your level, and then you're locking your hands right at their waist. And he would do that and just hoist guys off their feet and just, he launched everybody with it. And it didn't even matter. Like,
it didn't matter who it was. They couldn't stop it, right?
No. And they were getting underhooks on him, and he didn't even care. He would just lock a body lock around their underhooks, and it didn't matter. So I think if you want to watch, I think Greco is an acquired taste for one. And then I think if you just want to watch
it there, like, compared to Olympic, right? It's two different levels.
Right. So I think if you want to just watch like amazing throws, you can certainly find that at the highest levels, but it's a little more rare just because the guys are so good. But if you watch those mismatches, you see the guy just absolutely dominate and hit these amazing
throws.
Right
on the cards over the past winter, I remember watching some of the cards, and they'd throw like a Greco match in the, you know, the Rockfin cards or whatever. And it's like,
yeah,
they were like tossing them and, you know, teching them real quick. It's pretty wild. You know, he's like, oh, well, this guy's a little bigger because sure notice. It's like, oh, look, and that explains it, right?
Yeah. And sometimes I watch those matches and it's like, it's almost alarming. Like, I don't know how those guys don't get hurt more. Like, it's incredible. Like, especially like, I feel like the younger guys, like, there's a guy named Peyton Omania, I think you pronounce his last name. He wrestles at Michigan State. Really good Greco guy who now does folk style, but I think still does Greco kind of as well. But he's like, he'll like grab a body lock and he'll just pull you backwards. He'll sprint backwards and then just launch you, and you kind of just land where you land. And it's a violent sport.
Yeah. Like, yeah.
It's,
yeah. Ooh, I mean, talk about the difference between folk style and, you know, freestyle and Greco. I mean, it definitely is violent, right? There's no saving you. There's
no,
you're going. Yeah.
It's a cool sport. I think I'm liking it a lot more the more I watch it. There's like anything, there's certain nuances to it that you pick up as you watch more of it. But it's cool to watch, especially. And it's another thing too, is you start getting to know the guys.
Yeah.
Like, you get just like in the, you know, you know the US guys, or maybe you know some of the good guys from the other countries. Once you know them, I feel like you start to become a fan, or, you know, it gets a little bit more exciting when you have familiarity with the athletes.
100%. That's definitely, you know, you meet a wrestler or see, you know, interview on him, right? I mean, that's, you know, how the Olympics draws you in, kind of, right? They do the whole, you know, the music to the interview, and they draw you in, like, oh, I like this person, right? And then they get you to watch the event. Uh-huh. So obviously you mentioned, like, right, like a 2-minute video, you got like 2 hours into it, right? It takes time to review the video, to put your touches on it, right? That, like, people don't realize, like, they probably, you know, the average person probably thinks, oh, he just snaps these videos out, right? So what is your setup? Like, you mentioned you're watching these, you know, Olympics, but like, what do you watch it and then you got to go back, or what's your setup like? Do you got setup?
So I'll tell you exactly what I do. So I have a, you know, screen recording software. It's called OBS.
Yeah.
Anybody can download it. It's free. Mm-hmm. So I'll use that to, you know, record anything I'm watching, either live or
track. Like, we stream our events that use OBS for streaming track wrestling, you know, when we have our events and things like that.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I'll grab the footage. So I'll usually just find a clip that I'm interested in. I'll grab it with OBS, and then I pull it into a video editing software that I have. I use Adobe Premiere Pro, but I think any.
But do you, like, while you're watching this, do you just watch it and enjoy it first and then do it? You know what I mean?
Yeah. Some, I try to,
in the event.
I try to enjoy it, but sometimes I'm like, I get, it's such a cool move and I want to like put it out there.
Yeah.
But yeah, usually I'll watch it first and then come back later and do that.
It, right.
Yeah. Right.
Or not to. Right?
Yeah. I'm thinking about Dakes. I don't know if you watched the Olympic team trials, Dakes throw against Nolf in the semis. Right. That one, I was just like, I got to put this up immediately. Like, this was just, it was just amazing.
We'll be able to sleep if you don't. Right.
Yeah. So yeah, but generally I'll wait a little bit after the event. And a lot of my videos are just older matches too. So I'll just pull them up on YouTube and just kind of record the part that I want to show. So then I'll drag the file into a video editing software. And then from there I can go frame by frame. So I can go really
slow, just, right.
Yeah. So I can slow it down, or I can go frame by frame, and I'm trying to figure out, okay, like what happened here? Like what's the footwork depending on the move? Like, what's the hand fighting? What's the setup? What made it work? So I'm trying to, like, you know that it worked, so you're reverse engineering it.
Why?
So why did this work? And, you know, a lot of it to some extent is speculation. That's why for my videos, right, I have the same guy doing the same move multiple times. Then you have like a sense of like, oh, this is not just like a fluke. Like, he's able to do this repeatedly.
Right.
So Sitikov, the Russian guy, like, he hits that slide by, or some people call it a shrug, or he hits the move against everybody. So it's like, that's his like trademark move. Like, what is he doing to allow him to do that? And then you start picking up things. Okay. So Sitikov, he always hits it with his right arm, he uses like a right arm hook. So it's when the opponent has a left arm collar tie or a left arm inside tie, he does it against either.
Okay.
So what he's doing is, so I watched multiple clips. Okay. Is there like a similarity here? Okay. He's digging a right underhook. And when the opponent defends with an inside tie with their left arm, he's hooking the tricep. He hooks his right arm inside, grabs the tricep, and then he's pivoting. He's throwing the arm and he is like yanking the collar tie to him. Right. And so So it's all of those elements and you see it over and over. And so you can kind of figure out, okay, these are the details that matter, because I see him doing this in like all the videos. So you get that sense of it. And so I think that's a big thing is seeing it multiple times. And then I think once you've broken down film for a while, you get a sense for, you get a better sense for why something works or doesn't work. And, almost like a grappling IQ, for lack of a better word, you start picking up, on certain things. Trying to think of an example. So, I mean, this goes back to like the Iranian underhook, like they're getting the underhook. And then I did a video series on a guy, nobody's probably heard of this guy unless you're really into freestyle wrestling, but his name's Yonez Emami. He's a 70 kilogram wrestler for Iran. He has this whole system of, he gets an underhook. Okay. Then he has like four or five different options and you can see, okay, if the opponent does this and he'll probably do that, if they do this, he'll do that. And so you can really, get a sense for someone's game through watching the film.
He's gonna, if they go here, he's gonna go right to this, right?
Yeah, right. So he'll go, he's got his throw by, he's got a single leg that he'll do off the throw by. He's got, he can snap you down from there. He can, there's this move where I've only seen Iranians hit this move. It's called a standing, they call it Rakabi, I'm told. In Persian, but it's essentially like, if you think about like a whip over, I think we call it that, someone shoots in on you, you have an underhook, an overhook, and you kind of whip them over. Mm-hmm. It's basically that, but it's when the opponent's like totally on their feet and like, you just grab an underhook, you get the far tricep, and then you're able to get them to their back essentially off this. It's like, it's really kind of cool, a cool move. And a lot of them do it. So you pick up stuff like that too. Okay. What are they doing that's allowing them to hit this? Cause you can't just, if you try to just like muscle people with it, it'll never work.
Not going to work. Right.
Never. So there, a lot of it is you start seeing things like, okay, they're driving in and then they're getting pushed back. So that's, they have this like momentum factor. The pivot that they do is super drastic. So when they kind of do the whip over movement, they're putting their head like all the way down to the side and they're bending their knee and they're, it's this like big hip pivot involved with it. So I think what film study gives you is it's like one thing it gives you is you can really analyze the mechanics of something in a way that if you just watch it live, you'll never be able to pick it up because it's too fast.
You can see every body part where it's,
yeah,
you know, the off foot or the hip or whatever it may be. Right.
Yeah. So you can take your time and see what exactly. Like what everybody, like, what is his foot doing? What is his arm doing? What is his head doing? You know, what's the timing? Like, and you have unlimited time to kind of, figure that out, because you're not just watching a live speed or even a slow motion speed. You're literally just going back and forth frame by frame. So I like it. I don't know if everybody likes this stuff. And maybe I'm just like wired weirdly that this stuff is like really interesting to me. But you know, that makes it fun to share, because I think people, even if they maybe don't like spending a lot of time kind of doing it themselves, they at least enjoy like seeing what it looks like. So I think that's kind of
right. Yeah.
Yeah.
It might be crazy. You know, people take in, you know, content differently, right? Some people like to read, some people like to see, but obviously with technique there, you know, you got to see it in action. Right. And
for sure,
the way you break it down, it's pretty cool. And you know, put the graphics in there. It's like, wow, it's dummy proof, right? Here's what's going on. Here's what's happening. And you go slow. It's pretty sweet, man. Real sweet. Yeah, actually, it's
appreciate it.
Pretty cool. Like I said, small world that never would have known you're from Northeast Ohio. It's pretty cool. So
yeah.
Anything else you want to talk about? Or, you know, you had a few questions. I know there, I usually don't get questions, but.
Oh, really?
No, I don't, but I like it because it's more of a natural conversation. But
yeah, tell me more about your background. So you're a four-time state champion in Ohio. Yeah. There hasn't been that many of those, right? How many have there been?
There's a lot lately, right? I was number nine, and then since then, you know, it kind of, you know, it just seems to be more. So there's not a whole lot. I couldn't tell you the exact number now, but yeah.
Okay.
So yeah, I'm oldest of four brothers. We all wrestled.
Yeah, so I looked up, I saw like, did they all have a ton of success? Because I looked at like the OHSA website, so, and you guys are all the same high school, all the same last name, all on the record books for like wins and most pins and consecutive. It's pretty nuts.
Yeah, it was you know, small school. Like I said, we did other sports, and you know, our coach, who happened to be our uncle, actually, you know, had a great run from. You know, they started a youth program mid-80s, and we kind of came right in line. You know, I started, you know, I was there 96 to 99, and my youngest brother graduated in 09, so he was right around your age. But and that, like, from early 90s through late 2000s, it was like finished in the top 10 every year, and I think like 1 year they're outside of the top three. And like, so I mean, you're 25 years, I think they might've been 2 years outside of the top five or something crazy, like run. And like my brother in 01, I've told this story before, he had 15 boys in his graduating class. It was great, like crazy small school. So not only were we a small school, we were at the small end of the small end. You know what I mean? So,
yeah. Wow.
But they had a group, you know, like I said, my uncle was a coach. We had another coach, Mark Heemstra, and then a group of dads that just, you know, it was, you know, we wrestled during season, a little bit out of season, but you know, they had a good group of guys, and like, you know, you've seen it at Ignatius, right? You got a group, a good room, it you know, things happen. So, but yeah, you know, myself and my brothers, you know, we're fortunate too. Cause I mean, you've seen it, right? You said you have, you know, the neck issues, right? We were pretty blessed. We really didn't have any, my one brother had shoulder surgery in high school, but you know, an injury can change a season real quick. Right. Or, you know, things like that. But, so we were pretty blessed with, you know, injuries and things like that. But yeah, I mean, it's, you know, pretty fortunate, you know, we had a good support system at home and in the room and all around. So.
Yeah, that's really cool. I mean, especially at such a small school to have that much success.
Sweet. Yeah. It's looking back, it's kind of wild. You know, and when you're living in it, it's like, you know, it's cool.
Yeah.
And it's like, wow, how'd this happen type thing. You know?
Did all your brothers wrestle in college too?
Yeah. We all ended up at Kent State, the two youngest, okay. Like I said, high school, not a lot of injuries, but the two youngest had shoulder issues, later on, but, yeah, we all ended up at Kent State. So, you know,
okay.
Yeah. It was, like I said, crazy how that works, you know, it's small, you know, small school, then you go on to college, it's a little different, but you know, I wrestled at Kent State, you know, went to NCAAs a couple times. My brother Drew, he qualified for NCAAs. So
nice.
So yeah, it's, you know, now we're all back in wrestling some way or another. But yeah, it's, you know, a lot of people put time into us, right. To coach us and put time into us. So we're, you know, trying to give back in a way too. So.
Okay. Very cool.
Yeah. Nothing exciting.
Nah, I mean, it's sweet. Yeah. I think it's cool.
Yeah. No, it's cool. It's yeah, I think we're lucky, you know, from a wrestling side of things, being in Ohio, right. I mean, being in a tradition rich state of wrestling.
Yeah.
So
yeah, it's great. That was one of my favorite things about when I wrestled was, it was just so cool. Like the Ohio wrestling community was just cool. It's just like, I don't know. It's such like a tight knit, and everybody knew like who the best guys were. It was like, they would talk about like, remember like Lance Palmer was like some mythical creature. Like you see him, you're like, oh my God. Like it's just like, it's like such a, I don't know how to describe it. It's just like its own universe. And that was cool to discover when I was in it. So
yeah, talking about him, like we talked earlier, kind of the past, like when he was at Ohio State, I remember talking to him. And he knew he was going to MMA. Like that was his route. He wasn't going freestyle. You know what I mean? So it's kind of, you know, some of these guys know that's their route. So in jiu-jitsu, that made me think of something. You know, Ohio has a rich wrestling tradition. Is there like pockets of the United States that are kind of jiu-jitsu wise, kind of like the hotbed of the states?
Yeah. So I would say California is probably the bit. And that's just because all the Brazilians want to live, you know, in California, where the climate's probably mostly Brazil.
Yeah.
I would say California. I mean, New York City is pretty big. There's a lot of good gyms there.
What are some of the big gyms in the country that, I mean, is it?
Yeah. So, it's a totally different than wrestling in the sense that it's not like in colleges, right? So it's not in like the scholastic world. So it's all privately run businesses, essentially. They're usually the best schools are like, it depends how you describe best, but like for me, it's like the competition gyms that have like the best guys. There's a couple famous ones. I mean, there's one in New York City that produced a lot of the best, like Gordon Ryan, if you've heard of that name, Gary Tonin.
I've heard Gary Tonin. Okay.
That's there's a guy named John Donaher who's he's don't probably
like crazy. Like he's like they're like trained like crazy, don't they?
Yeah. So he's kind of he's like people consider him like the best instructor in jiu-jitsu. So he's really very analytical. Yeah. I think he studied philosophy at like a PhD level. So he's just like, it's his whole life. Right. And he's produced.
Eat, breathes, and they,
that's it. I don't think he has a family. Right, I think, right. You know, just jiu-jitsu. So it's hard to compete with that. If you're, if you're another coach. And I think he's a guy that probably just watches film all day too, but he's produced a lot of really good guys in New York. And then there's a couple schools. There's a school called Atos in San Diego. I actually got to train there one time. It was pretty sweet, but that's another school that is known for like having a lot of good guys. And then of course, Brazil, there's still biggest, I guess the most prominent athletes kind of move to the US because that's where they can make a better living generally. Okay. But there's still a ton of really good competitors in Brazil. So that's still a hotbed. The sport is still kind of in its infancy and at least compared to wrestling. So I would say it's still very much Brazilians dominating at the highest level. There are more Americans now that are winning world championships, but for the longest time it was pretty exclusive, pretty much exclusively Brazilians. But yeah, now you're starting to see Americans. There's a couple Australian guys that are doing really well. And then, you know, Canadians, and it's becoming more international by the year. So it's kind of cool to see the sport really grow just because it's so much newer than most other sports that have been, you know, more established. So that's an interesting aspect of it. And then there's just like the whole, I guess the fact that it's very much private business and then more entrepreneurial, it's very entrepreneurial compared to wrestling.
Right.
And so that kind of lends itself to some interesting things. Like there's a lot of jiu-jitsu guys who can now do it full time. Like you can make a good living, I think, as a jiu-jitsu competitor. I mean, I'm sure wrestlers do too, but I don't know the business world of the wrestling as much as I do jiu-jitsu. I mean, you can make a decent money now competing. You could put out instructionals that can sell really well if you market them well. You can go to Europe and do seminar circuit. We call them seminars in jiu-jitsu. I think wrestling calls them clinics or something.
Clinics or camps or
yeah. So because the sport's getting big internationally, jiu-jitsu guy, like big athletes can go around and make a good living that way. And then of course, a lot of them also own their own gym. So, you know, it's like a traditional small business. If you run it well, you can make a good living.
Yeah, you're seeing more wrestlers do that. You know, David Taylor, he has, so you're seeing definitely more of the private, which is good, right? If you get more full-time people in the sport, the better, I feel.
I think so too. Yeah. Is that newer in wrestling, you think, that like
kind of a private? Definitely newer. And I guess that, yeah, it's definitely newer. You've always had some, but you're definitely seeing more, more people, which is good. I think, I just hope it doesn't, there's that balancing act too. You know, you're hearing these colleges cutting programs. So it's like, okay, if they take it out of the schools, what's that mean? More like jiu-jitsu, is that a good thing or a bad thing? I don't know, but
probably pros and cons, but I mean, just certainly having the institutional support of like these big colleges has to be good to some extent. I mean,
right. Yeah. But you still don't know what this, the NIL is going to do. You know what I mean? What the name, image and likeness is going to do in the 10 years, we don't know. Right.
Yeah.
But Title IX was going to, who thought that would have, decimated wrestling programs, 40 years ago, over how long, 30 years ago, however
right.
long it was ago. So it's going to be interesting to see, and,
you're seeing a lot more women's programs from what I understand.
Right. Yeah.
Which seems, that seems great for the sport, the growth. Right. And it's half the population right there that.
Exactly. And you're exactly right. We're trying to market the sport to half the population, you have basketball, you can market to, men's and women's. And I definitely, we talked to Olympics, right? The success we had, right? Amira Mensastock, you tell me a more marketable person, right?
And she's unstoppable. Right? It's unbelievable. Yeah.
So I see the upside there, right? Definitely. So we'll see though, right? You never know. You never know how it all is going to shake out, but it's definitely, I think, headed in the right direction. So,
mm-hmm.
so. Yep. Well, cool, man. Anything else, man? I could talk all night, man. Usually don't share I didn't talk a whole lot about myself, but keep the conversation about you. People are tuning in to hear you, not me.
I don't know. They want to hear about you too. I don't know. I think that's probably it for me. Thanks. Thanks again for having me on. I really appreciate it. Yeah. Would love to do an in-studio one sometime. That would be cool.
Yeah, meet up in person or something. We're not far apart at all. So
no.
we'll have to connect again. I loved hearing your story and your background. It's pretty cool to hear you're the guy behind, all the breakdowns and hear, the whys and the hows and, what's your passion. So thanks for your time, man. I appreciate it.
Yep, absolutely.
Yeah. It's time to start planning for next season's tournaments. Be sure you have Smitty's Corner Rugs on your mats to protect them and keep them clean. Get a hold of him directly at smitty43952@gmail.com. If you have a tournament, it's the way to go. It creates a custom coach's box so your tournament runs efficiently and keeps the mats clean since they use a top spray MRSA killer.
Anyway, I was just saying to you there, how I've got corner, rug inventory. 'Tis the season.
It's the season right now.